would like to introduce real quick Joseph Patrick here.
Yep.
From the German periodical Gegenstandpunkt. It's a Marxist kind of newspaper, quarterly. And I've been invited here last year, both from Germany. And he's talking about the crisis, and we're trying to promote a group, Ruthless Criticism. .com. It's on the website. Flyers are out there. The books are $5 besides the Democratic States, unfortunately, $8. Sorry, it's only four. The only four left copies we have. These four copies are the only ones we have left. But they're also available for free of download. So that's all. Let's see. We can learn about it first.
Okay. Also wanted to thank the guys from Ruthless Criticism for inviting me. I'm actually from California. It's nice to be able to do politics in my own state. I don't get the opportunity all that often. What I wanted to talk to you about tonight, you all saw in the flyers, it's about the current economic crisis. And the basic history of the crisis, what's gone over the last few years, the basic story is pretty much clear to everyone, or clear enough to everyone. If you take a look at the different information sources you can find in the internet or elsewhere, you can get a general idea of the so-called chain reaction that ran from a rather new and exotic sector of the securities trade with the whole alphabet soup of securities, asset-backed securities, ABS, CDOs, CDSs, and all kinds of new terms that we've gotten to learn. This chain reaction ran from disturbances in that section of the financial sector to a near total collapse of the banking system and to a near collapse of the general economy, the entire economy itself. The effects of it have been enormous. Statisticians report potentially 50 million additional deaths from starvation, skyrocketing unemployment numbers in the more advanced countries, a dramatic drop in industrial production and in exports. The crisis already has a few bankrupt states under its belt, and currencies across the globe are tanking. So the crisis is here. And how has the general public reacted to all this? On the one hand, with a great deal of moral outrage. Outrage at London City Boys, or the guys on Wall Street, who didn't understand their own creations, who did irresponsible business that was doomed to fail from the beginning. These guys have the worst reputation that they've had in years, perhaps since the 80s. On the other hand, that moral outrage has long since turned into the hope that the banking system itself get back onto its feet as soon as possible. Most people faced with the consequences of a failure of the banking system hope that the same banking system, whose agents they constantly criticize in very, very harsh moral tones, that they get back to business. Perhaps with the one change that their business be more reliable and more secure in the future. Same business, more reliable, more secure. And for that reason, so that the economy can get going again, most are willing to make many sacrifices. The unions, on the one hand, especially in the auto industry, making compromises on wages and working hours. Many people also accept that America needs to raise its savings rate. Well, what that means is most people will have to accept the limits that their poverty imposes on them. If you have no income, no job, no assets, that also means you're not allowed to have a house. That's basic economic sense. Others will have to recognize that they can't afford a second automobile or a first automobile, regardless of how much they might need it. And these are all the costs people are willing to bear for a return to the status quo. And by doing that, by hoping for and even demanding a return to the normal state of affairs, people are ignoring the lessons that the crisis itself has to teach us about the capitalist economic system and what its consequences are for its inhabitants. The lessons that the crisis itself is teaching, that's what I want to talk about tonight. I want to draw some simple conclusions from what we've had to experience over the last few years of the crisis, Perhaps some of these conclusions might even seem obvious to some. But one thing's for certain, if the conclusions I might draw from the crisis seem obvious, they're certainly not being taken seriously. What I mean by that, I hope, will become more clear. The first lesson I want to talk about that the crisis teaches has to do with the nature of the so-called real economy. And the very first thing we might learn from an economic crisis, especially at this scale, is just what an absurd situation an economic crisis actually is. It's clear to everyone that an economic crisis means a drastic rise in poverty, sometimes almost even a total breakdown of the material reproduction process of society. And yet, is there actually a lack of anything? Is there a lack of goods for consumption? No, in fact, we hear of overfilled store shelves, excess inventory. We hear of homes, a rash of foreclosures. It's an interesting thing. The so-called housing crisis that started a few years ago, nothing to do with the shortage of houses. There's even a surfeit of houses. Plenty of goods. A surfeit of houses, too many goods. Excess inventory, too much. Maybe there's a lack of means of production to produce things people need. Certainly not. We hear of excess capacity in the auto industry. Too many means to produce goods. And there's certainly not too little labor power to produce all these useful things. Rocketing unemployment numbers mean too many people. The question is, too much for what? Certainly not, there's not too much of all this for the needs of the needy. Many would love to be able to move into a house. In fact, there's increasing homelessness. They would love to get into one of these houses. People would jump at the opportunity to get a hold of one of the cars that's on the overfilled car lots. And the same goes for jobs. What the capitalist crisis manages to achieve is something that no other society has ever managed to achieve. This society doesn't suffer from older society suffered from a shortage of certain goods. This society suffers in the face of an overabundance of goods, overabundance of wealth in all its forms. Not too much for the needs of the people, but too much for the purpose of turning a sum of money into more money. Too many houses, too many goods, too many means of production, and too many people for that purpose, taking a sum of money and making more out of it. And if that's the case, then these goods are deemed useless. Poverty rises, goods are wasted, means of production wasted, raw materials too. That's an absurdity, again, that only capitalism can manage to achieve. That's not a reason to hope for the recovery of it. Maybe it's a reason to question that kind of economic system. But that being said, there is, of course, one thing that there is a shortage of at the moment: credit. We've all heard the term credit crunch, relatively new term for me. A credit crunch, too little credit. What does that actually teach us? If in this economy there's too little credit, then everything else stops. Material production stops. Clearly, credit is the most decisive economic resource in this economy. And maybe that's not too much of a secret to anyone. It's almost taken for granted now that if banks can't give loans, no production gets done, jobs don't get created, growth doesn't happen. But that's actually quite a remarkable fact, given the fact that credit itself, borrowed money, doesn't in and of itself contribute anything to the physical process of production. Credit, borrowed money, doesn't facilitate labor, doesn't make working any easier, doesn't create machines with which goods could be produced, and it doesn't create raw materials. If the purpose of the real economy was just to combine these things and make useful goods, credit would be superfluous. Why would you need borrowed money? You have everything you need. And a credit crunch certainly couldn't affect the real economy. Wouldn't be a shortage of it, you wouldn't need it. But clearly credit is useful for this economy. The question is, for what? Credit is useful for financing production. What does that mean? Credit is useful for gaining access to and getting hold of all the sources of wealth in the society to be able to produce more. Getting a hold of all the things from which a producer would otherwise be excluded. If you don't have borrowed money, if you don't have money, you can't get a hold of all the things that are needed to produce goods. The usefulness of credit, the basis for its great reputation, therefore has to do with the fact that all wealth in this economy, all wealth in this society, is private property. Objects that are subjected to the exclusive ownership of their owners. On that basis, credit is useful. That's a remarkable thing. Everyone takes for granted. Money, borrowed money is useful. If you don't have loans, you can't do anything. Only because everything won't be used for production, not for goods, unless the owners of those goods have their money needs satisfied. What that means is credit's usefulness is based on the fact that everything is subjected to the rule of private property in this economy. That's an unpleasant fact. So, in the form of credit, this power to get access to and get hold of goods, all the sources of wealth, in order to produce more money. In the form of credit, that goods becomes a tradable commodity. It can be bought and sold, or rather lent and borrowed. A bank advances a sum of money to an employer who's allowed to use that property as if it were his own, gets a hold of the money, can produce more money, pays the bank back. The price that an employer needs to pay for that power is interest. Obvious enough, but what does that mean? That means getting credit is only a useful transaction for a capitalist. For, say, more neutral, a producer in the so-called real economy, is only a useful transaction if he can use that money in order to command labor, other people's labor, in such a way as to produce more wealth for himself, higher than the interest rate. Credit is only useful for him if he can use it to make a profit. And credit does just that. It expands a producer's ability to command labor, to exploit it, to create additional profit. That's what he uses credit for. And if a producer can't get a hold of that credit, then he's out of the competition. If a whole real economy can't get a hold of credit, then there's no production. What that means is the real economy can only be affected by credit crunch, because it pursues the exact same purpose as the banks. Think of the good reputation that the economy has right now as a so-called real economy, busy with the production of goods and the creation of jobs. Perhaps it's never enjoyed a better reputation than now. But the fact that it can be affected by a so-called credit crunch, by a lack of credit, means that it's no different from the banks. Its purpose as well is to take money and to turn that money into more. Credit expands the power of capitalists to do that. So I just talk of the bad speculators on the one hand and the good producers on the other hand just makes no sense. There's an identity between them. Their purpose is the same. By the way, if there's any questions, you can go ahead and ask them and interrupt me, and I'll reserve the right to postpone the question if it gets in the way. Yeah.
Well, you formulated it a little different than I'm used to hearing. Usually, when they talk about overproduction and yet shortages within the society, they say due to the mode of operation of the capitalist system and the taking away of the surplus value that the worker creates in the form of profit, rent, and interest. The worker or all the producers cannot buy back the quantum of goods they throw out of the market. Therefore, pressure is created to find markets elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But the working class itself can never buy back the productive things that they throw in the market. Mm-hmm. And you formulated it a little differently. Mm-hmm. That's all I have to say. I don't know. That clarifies our muddies of water.
I'm not sure.
But I'm sure you agree with that, that due to the fact that the rentier and the capitalist take their profit and the landlord his rent out of the surplus value created by the worker, they can't possibly, the masses can't buy back the goods that they created. Mm-hmm. And that creates a shortage for them, a surfeit for the home market. And usually that leads to investing overseas.
Well, let me stop you right there. I actually wanted to make a more simple point. Instead of talking about where this crisis, you said overproduction, might have come from, first of all, I just wanted to point out what an absurd situation that is. Something that people take for granted, that there's factories that are empty, unemployment, surfeit of houses, etc. To really grasp the fact that an economic crisis itself is an indictment of capitalism. Only in this economy can there be too much wealth. Too much wealth not for the needs of the people, but for the purpose of turning money into more money. The crisis in that sense really clearly demonstrates, or you could say it casts an especially glaring light on the fact that all wealth in this economy and the needs of the people are subordinated to that purpose, turning money into more money. And that's something that the crisis itself teaches us. And the second point I wanted to make was to say, regardless of theories of overproduction or something like that, one thing that the crisis itself demonstrates is clear. A credit crunch, a lack of borrowed money, means that goods can't be produced. Now, if you think of how the general public has normally reacted to this, it's with the hope that banks will be able to provide loans again soon. The poor real economy is suffering. It's not able to produce goods for people. It's not able to create jobs for people, the things people want and need, because the banks aren't providing loans. The argument I want to make is the very fact that the so-called real economy can be affected by something like a lack of borrowed money proves that the purpose of that real economy is no different from the banks, that their purpose is identical, turning a sum of money into more money. That's what credit is useful for, and that's why a lack of credit is so fatal. Not a reason to cry for the producers, but a reason to get clear about what producers actually pursue, the interests that producers actually pursue in this economy. I want to make a further point on that note. What the crisis has taught us is that credit is not only a useful means, not only a convenience. If a lack of credit means bringing the entire process of production to a halt, then credit is obviously an indispensable means. As soon as firms no longer get access to credit, the capital they may have, the sources of wealth they may have, are useless. That teaches us that capitalists in this economy have long been doing business with means that go beyond their past business success.
Go beyond their
past business success. Yeah, they're investing money that don't arrive from their past proceeds, but from credit themselves, or credit itself. One could express it, capitalists are always living beyond their means in order to get bigger and to make what was beyond their means now within their means. That's the way they grow. Okay, that might not be a big secret, but what does that teach us? If the money capitalists have to do business is useless without additional borrowed money, without credit, that tells us that the means of producing this economy, not goods, not means of production, but rather debts. That's a remarkable thing. Most people try to avoid debts. It's a bad thing to be in debt. If you're in debt to a bank, it's a problem you have to deal with, a situation you want to avoid. But as far as the economy, as far as the business world goes, the real dominant producers, one could also say the purpose of production, debts are the lifeblood of the economy. Debts that function as capital. That is the wealth of a capitalist nation. Therefore, even if the business of companies, or even the business of companies that produce the most tangible goods, toothpaste, water bottles, etc. You can think of all kinds of useful goods. Even their business is a speculation on the future. In that sense, no different from the banks. If there is no anticipation of future success, let's say no confidence in future success, no credit, then there's no production. The most tangible business in the real economy is the speculative of the banks. Again, therefore, it's wrong to draw a distinction between bad speculators on the one hand, good, solid capitalists on the other hand, to produce useful things.
More
sense of the mere fact that the working class is exploited and by definition can buy back what it produces, this can be the reason for a crisis.
That would also be for deal with that after the talk. That's a difficult enough issue, and it's definitely worth getting into. So we'll reserve some time for that. First of all, just want to summarize the first real lesson, a real valuable lesson that the crisis teaches us. It's no secret that when the business of banks, or if banks aren't healthy, and if profit making suffers, then the people itself, especially the working class, are doomed. No opportunity to earn a living, or a much worse opportunity to earn a living. That's not a secret to anyone. It's something that many people have to experience. But what conclusion do they normally draw from that? They draw the conclusion, because I am dependent upon the health of the banks and the functioning of profit making, then I insist that everything be done so that that works again and my dependency works out, that I can have a chance to have a job again. Because I'm dependent upon that, it must be good for me. It's there for my sake. And what I want to say is the crisis itself teaches a different lesson. The conclusion we should draw from the crisis is that the economic aims of the people, the economic aims of the working class, is not the economic aim of this economy. Their reason for going to get work, to earn a livelihood, that's not the purpose of this economy. The purpose of this economy is turning money into more money. And if that doesn't work, well, then it's worth throwing them out on the street. Another way of putting the same point: if people only have jobs and labor is only performed if money can be turned into more money, then that's what their labor is good for. That's the purpose of them going to work, to produce profit, not to work for themselves. That might be their subjective reason for doing it, but that's not the objective reason. Okay, move on to the second point. I want to get into a little bit about the business of the banks themselves, the business of the banking system. What does the crisis teach us about the business that goes on in the financial sector, in the financial industry? Ever since the financial crisis has broken out, we've learned from politicians and the press that banks provide a crucial service to the economy, that they are the most crucial service provider in this economy. And the crucial service that they provide, like I've said tonight, is providing loans to the real economy. Providing loans to the real economy that allows it to create the goods and the services that we all need and want. But the crisis itself teaches us what a peculiar kind of service that is, and a peculiar kind of service provider. Can anybody name another service provider that, where the situation is such that when that service provider is no longer there or reduces his service, then the recipient of the service is ruined? The insurance industry, definitely part of the financial industry. Yeah? Barbers certainly couldn't say that. Neither could janitors. Even if an automaker, or maybe even several automakers, go broke, that's definitely nothing good. Nothing good for the economy. But does it ruin the entire economy? Well, probably not. When these service providers, even reduce their service a little bit, then it's a reason for a catastrophe. Well, if that's the case, maybe we need to invert our notion of who serves whom. If production comes to a halt as soon as banks are no longer willing or able to provide loans to the economy, then the economy serves the business of the banks and not the other way around. And so what do banks do? They either provide or withdraw this most decisive economic or capitalistic resource, loans. If they see prospects of business, they provide a loan, enable a capitalist to pursue profit. if they don't see prospects of profit, they withdraw loans, disable that production. In that sense, what banks do with their lending business is act as judges over what production should take place and what production is useless, with a view to their own profit calculations. Again, we can only call these, well, we can only call the financial industry a service industry in a very ironic sense. Perhaps the only service provider in this economy that actually lords over the economy. So let's step back a second and consider what it is that banks actually do. Actually, it's quite miraculous. Miraculous. Banks manage to turn money that they have into more money, but without engaging in or getting involved in the process that actually creates additional value. Without investing in means of production, without investing in labor or raw materials, without exploiting labor, none of that. Independent of that process, banks manage to turn money into more money. So how do banks do that? They do that by entering into legal contracts with debtors of all kinds, entering into loan contracts. They provide loans to companies, to governments, and to consumers. Regardless of what is done with the money, regardless of that, whether that money is actually used to create a profit, to create surplus value, banks increase their money. If I as a bank give a money to a consumer, the consumer certainly doesn't use that in order to start an exploitation process and to produce additional value, spends it maybe on a house, maybe on a car, the money is gone. Regardless of whether that money is used to create an additional value, the bank earns an additional value. Same for governments. Regardless of what is done with the sum of money that a bank has, the bank turns its money into capital simply by lending it out. That's a kind of capitalistic miracle. Especially those who might have read Marx, I think you learn, exploited labor is the only way to create additional value, the only way to earn a profit. Banks teach us that that's not necessarily true. Banks make money by entering into legal contracts. By virtue of these legal contracts, turning their money into more money. Other businesses turn money into capital by investing in an exploitation process. In the hands of the bank, money is capital as soon as it is lent out. In that sense, the business of banks is capitalism in its most pure and perfect form. They achieve the purpose of all capitalistic activity, turning money into more money, let's say without going through the detour of actually having to exploit labor and create additional value. They realize the purpose of all capitalistic activity in a very immediate and direct way. Another way of putting it, in the business of the banks, the subordination of all wealth and its sources to the purpose of turning money into more money achieves its most pure and perfect expression. This is really the kind of tough economic part of the talk, but it's worth getting into it a little bit. Little bit of economic education. Just to reflect on this, it's often taken for granted that banks make money simply by giving it out and getting back. My point is, it's actually a kind of miracle, one that deserves explanation. Others do business with things like means of production, labor, in order to accumulate profits. Banks do business with the power to command all sources of wealth. What they really trade in is power over property, power over all material goods and sources of wealth, especially other people's labor. And what's remarkable about that is, if you think a minute for what is capital, really. Capital, something maybe everyone knows, value that becomes more value. Self-expanding value is Marxist, or is the translation of Marxist term. In that sense, value that becomes more value. How does that work? Through a process of production, exploitation, sale of a profit. Capital, in that sense, is a social relationship of power, exclusion, and force. Money doesn't become more simply by virtue of its own power, but by getting hold of means of production and labor and creating a profit. But the bank sells this relation, this is an awkward term, but the bank sells this relationship of force and exclusion as an actual thing. It sells the power to command the sources of wealth. That's what it does when it gives a loan, earns a profit. Marx says about that, that's the most fetishistic, or that's capitalism in its most fetishistic form. This thing really is the power to become more. And yet that's what the banks really do. That's the reality of the banking business. It's not merely a theoretical, let's say, a theoretical madness. In the business of the banks, they make that true every day. The successful sale of a relationship of force and exclusion that they made productive for their own enrichment. What banks make come true in their own business is that if you have money in this economy, you have everything you need to create more money. If you have money, you have capital. The only thing you need in this economy to get more money is to have money. That's what the banks prove, and that's the experience they have in their everyday lending business. And this practical knowledge, what I mean by practical knowledge is this experience that the banks have every day in their lending business, that money in their hands is capital. That forms the basis of that other branch of the financial industry whose dimensions cause so much astonishment. That would be the securities trade. Sales, stocks, and bonds, the center of what is the current financial crisis. Securities trade is complicated enough. If you read in the newspapers or go look in Wikipedia or elsewhere in textbooks, you can find lots of explanations of how that actually works. Trade with stocks and bonds and other derivatives. But what I want to take a little time on tonight is to find out what is the principle of that actually. To say a few words of the principle of that business that some people might call a casino, others call really important, but the principle it is never really grasped. What banks do in the security trade, again, it's rather miraculous. They make money, in this case, by issuing and purchasing securities. They make money independent of the actual process of capital accumulation. They don't invest in a company and take share in its profits. They do business with each other. And what do they do business with? With their power to turn money into capital. How does that work? What do issuers of securities do? Someone who issues stocks or issues a bond. They take incoming payments from the whole spectrum of their activities, be it their loans to governments, to consumers, for instance, mortgage payments, loans to capitalist companies. Take that incoming stream of payments and take the liberty to postulate an underlying capital that's yielding that stream of payments and selling that capital to the investment community and turning it into money. In their lending business, they experience and they execute the following process, turning money into capital. In the securities trade, an issuer of security takes that so far to take any incoming stream of money, simply postulating a capital that underlies it, taking that so seriously as to be able to sell it as an object and turning that back into money.
Buying stocks on margin, leverage.
Yeah, what do you mean? Well, I would say not necessarily just on margin. Issuing stocks in general is this process. incoming stream of payments, objectified in, or capital postulates an underlying capital and sells that capital as a stock or share. You can purchase it, that's what the investors do, purchase it, and by buying that, you have what? Actually a piece of paper that performs all the functions normally performed by a process of exploitation, creating additional value. You invest in capital. In the securities trade, capital is traded as a thing. And these banks get enormously wealthy on this. And what is that capital that's yielding all these stream of payments for investors in stocks and bonds? Capital is actually made up of debts. Streams of incoming payments. That's the basis for postulating an underlying capital and selling it. That means that the greatest fortunes in this society, the wealth upon, well, the wealthiest dimensions we've definitely gotten to know since the crisis, that all consists in debts. That is the wealth of the market economy. Debts, again here, that function as capital. And that, by the way, is proven by the crisis. Think about the chain reaction I mentioned at the very beginning. A chain reaction that now, at least most people know the general links of how it worked. We learned that, for instance, the most prominent case, when Lehman Brothers collapsed. This didn't mean that Citibank was happy. This didn't mean that Morgan Stanley was happy to have a competitor be wiped away from the market. The first thing that happened was they realized that that's a catastrophe. What does that tell us? If their competitor fails, then they're in danger of failure. Well, that shows that the assets that these banks have consist in the debts of the others. A debtor's failure means the destruction of the assets of the others. The destruction of his assets means the destruction of another bank's assets. What the crisis itself proves is that the wealth of investment banks, really the lords of the market economy, their wealth consists in debts. And what I would urge you to do is to not say, well, that certainly is irresponsible. How irresponsible? Let's get back to the real economy. I'd really like to urge you to remember the first point. Capitalism in general means the purpose is turning money into more money. Money that functions as capital, debts that function as capital, that's the market economy. That's not a reason to draw a distinction between banks that are irresponsible and a real economy that's responsible, but to really grasp what the nature of wealth is in this economy. The last lesson I want to get to is actually a lesson that's taught by the state itself, that the government has taught in the course of the crisis. And this has to do with the state's bailout. The state's bailout of the banks. If we recall the situation over the last few, or let's say last summer, and that must have been actually a little bit before that now, the financial system was racing towards the edge. Major banks were going broke or were already broke. The entire global market economy stood at the brink. And then governments in the major capitalist countries mobilized dizzying sums of money. In America, this was the clearest. $700 billion mobilized like that. Sums that were just absolutely astonishing. All of it to save big investment banks from failure and to fend off the horrendous consequences of a failure of the banking system. And what do we learn from that? Well, clearly the state does not regard the financial industry as a business like any other. That's not a big secret. If a company fails, that's something that the creditors and the debtors of that company, well, the company itself has to deal with its creditors. If private individuals go bankrupt, that's something that they have to work out with their creditors. There's plenty of laws for that, but that's certainly not a natural catastrophe. The failure of the one is the success of its competitors, and the market economy marches on. But if a bank fails, then the government is much more concerned. The failure of even an individual bank of a decent size is an emergency that has to be dealt with, and the failure of the banking system is a national catastrophe. And it's actually quite interesting. We've heard many, many creative metaphors from politicians in the press on this. If banks fail, a slew of banks, then a meltdown threatens. The economy was standing at the abyss. Since I haven't been in America, I'm not sure what the other... I'm sure there was lots of other creative metaphors. But one of my favorites was Henry Paulson saying, when he was in front of the, I think, Senate committee, said, "Gentlemen, if you don't save the banks today, tomorrow you won't have an economy to save anymore." In the eyes of the state, a bank failure is, in short, an apocalyptic scenario. And for that very reason, the bailout itself enjoys both a very good and a very bad reputation. The good reputation is, well, many are impressed, first of all, by the ability of the state to intervene, actually save the banks, and thereby to save our economy. And many, especially on the left, are pleased to see the government reestablish its authority over the market. They see the doctrine of neoliberalism refuted and are happy to see a return to an economy where the state plays a big role in regulation. At the same time, many others have complained of what they regard to be a glaring injustice. Billions for the banks, further sacrifices for the rest, for taxpayers, homeowners, etc. They argue that if the state apparently doesn't have any trouble mobilizing such enormous sums for the banks, then it certainly must have enough to be able to provide for schools, do more for poverty, a whole list of social tasks that the state might be able to perform with such enormous sums of money. But the state's response shows how inappropriate both these reputations are. I'm not sure if any of you had a chance to see it, but a few weeks ago, Ben Bernanke gave an interview on a three-day interview, actually, on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And it was a town hall meeting, and one of the people in the audience asked him, "How could you do that?" With a great deal of moral outrage. How could you save the very people who caused the crisis and impose further sacrifices on the rest of the economy? And he said, "I'm as upset as you are, but given the fact that if the banks fail, everything else fails, we simply have to hold our nose and save the banks." And there might be many who see that as a certain kind of cynicism or hypocrisy. But I think we would do well to take that lesson seriously. If the head of the central bank says, "If I don't save the banks, then the economy is gone," well, that tells us the business of the banks is this economy. That tells us that the wealth of this society doesn't consist in goods, in houses, in means of production. It consists in the power to finance. It consists in the power to finance sources of finance wealth production, to finance capital accumulation. That's what Ben Bernanke is teaching us. That's a lesson we should listen to. In this economy, the wealth is power to get hold of goods, not the goods themselves. Power to get hold of goods for the purpose of turning money into more money. If that doesn't work, nothing else works. This intervention on the part of the government is also instructive in another sense. It reveals the nature of that wealth. As I talked about, it's power. That means that wealth in this economy, you think it's something that's just economic. Something to do with economic calculations, nothing political. But what the bank's intervention proves is that the wealth of this economy is thoroughly political. It's thoroughly backed by state force. if the political power of the state is what rescued the banks, and with that the entire economy and its wealth, assets of big companies, assets of investment banks, but also savings of the normal people, then this economy is not only founded upon the force of the state, but then money is a product of state force. It is the power to get access to sources of wealth. If the power to finance is the wealth of the nation, then the wealth of nation of the nation is a relationship of power. It's the power of exclusive ownership over wealth and the power to get hold of that wealth. And finally, I pointed out that the wealth of this nation is very political. But the manner of the state's intervention also teaches us something else. How much the state insists that the political purpose of that wealth is private property, and to accumulate as private property. That fact is illustrated, first of all, by the constraints that the government imposes upon itself in saving the banks. Even while directly intervening in the economy, it didn't, let's say, suspend the profit calculations of the banks. It provided them with liquidity. What the state looked to do with its rescue program was to improve the conditions for the bank's business, even to provide them with the means, but never to take away the calculations of the bank. Even in cases where the state nationalized the banks, as in England, it made perfectly clear, we're not going to get involved with its lending operations, and even if we do, then it's to compel the banks to do their own business. To make liquidity, to make the money that's given to them productive for their own enrichment. That's how much the state, with all its political force, insists that wealth in this economy is private accumulation. Wealth in this economy is private property. That insistence is also made clear by the powerlessness, the ultimate powerlessness of the state to restore the economy. Can improve the conditions for banks. It can even create stimulus packages of different kinds. But whether that actually stimulates the economy, whether growth actually happens, that's up to the economy. And even if the economy gets going again, there's fears of inflation. Whether the state's intervention might have boosted the economy, but only at the cost of ruining the money of the state, ruining the money of the economy. What that moment of powerlessness, or that aspect of powerlessness, teaches us is just how much the state insists on two things. One, the wealth of my economy is political force. Second, the purpose of that political force is accumulation of private property in private hands for the purpose of private enrichment. Those are principles I'm not touching. The state is even willing to put the money of its own economy at risk in order to save that purpose, private accumulation. Those are three very difficult lessons that I went through. But the one thing I'd like to say in closing is the ultimate lesson is these things, the accumulation of private property, the accumulation of the power to get hold of sources of wealth in order to exploit labor and increase that money, that is what gets going again when the economy gets going again. That is what economic recovery means. And our hope is that if you understand that that's what economic recovery means, you'll lose the desire to hope for that economic recovery. That's all I have to say. Does anybody have any questions, comments, remarks, objections?
I guess I do.
Uh-huh.
It appears to me like if Bank A bilks Bank B out of something, there's more value in Bank A's pocket, but it doesn't create any new wealth in society and any new, what Marx would call surplus value. And the only way to do that, in a realistic way, is through the exploitation of labor and the manufacturing process or something. Now, it's true that in this society, the financial aspects became disengaged from and expectations way beyond the possibility of the productive forces, and that led to the enormous dislocation and the crisis itself. But I do not believe that banks themselves create new value. They don't build a dam, they don't create roads, I'll use a fancy word, you're hypothesizing the money equivalent of surplus value and saying that they're generating it. The money itself may draw an interest, but that's because it's advanced usually to a capitalist who uses to invest, and he expects to make more than the amount of interest that he pays. So in conventional Marxist term, the interest of the bank loan advances for capital purchase or maintenance of capital, and the rent that the capitalist may pay if he doesn't own the land are all derivative of the surplus value created by the worker. And so I can see how a bank can make all kinds of money, but that doesn't mean that new value was actually created in that society at all. It may be a parasitic thing that takes a long time to reconnect to the base and leads to a financial explosion. Well, that's how I would normally have formulated the crisis. And I honestly don't understand how you're saying that the banks, through some magic, actually create new value in the world. I don't understand them.
Okay.
Now, I'm not saying they don't say that. I'm not saying the capitalist economists don't say that. But I think it's a fraud perpetrated on the people so that they don't understand that it's a surplus labor that the worker, the totality of the quantum of workers aren't paid for, that creates the possibility for capitalists, bankers, landlords to get a share out of this surplus value that's not paid to the working class. And I'd like you to prove to me that they actually create new value. From my point of view, the whole capitalist class, rentier, financial, are parasites in a sense. Even if they pay the worker his market wage and what he's worth, as it were, they still don't create anything that builds up the world in any way whatsoever. They don't create a product, but you turn that into really creating new value. So explain that to me, other than repeating the same words.
Maybe to pick up on the last point you made, a distinction between, let's say, the real economy who build up things in the world. Yeah, workers produce things, use means of production, they build stuff, bridges, chairs, water bottles, tables, etc. Okay. And on the other hand, banks that are parasites on that, only interested in money. One thing one might ask is, the real economy, the process of using labor, since when has the purpose of that been to just build up bridges?
I didn't say purpose, I'm talking about source of value.
Source of value.
Of a new additional value in the world.
Okay, good.
Not one capitalist cheating another capitalist. So one guy had 10 million, now, and the other guy had 5, now the other guy has 12 million and he has less. But still the total quantum of value is still there. It doesn't increase or augment anything. And if it does falsely augment it, like it did in all the shenanigans, selling off derivatives and phony mortgages, it will lead to an explosion. Mm-hmm. And it always has. Mm-hmm. And a destruction of capital and wasting of old capital, allowing the capitalist class, the sections that aren't destroyed, to buy up cheaply and reinvest in new technology and not spend their money on the old technology. So That's my understanding. It doesn't mean it's correct. It might be archaic and conventional.
Right. One difficulty I have is the terms you use actually describe financial capital. Certainly not a fan of it. But if just take a look at the world and what banks actually do, for me it's hard to call that shenanigans or to see how, let's say, the money banks make on derivatives, yeah, on the most complex, intricate derivatives, how the wealth they create or the wealth that they make there, yeah, the money they make, how that's any more real than the money you can get by exploiting labor.
You mean less real?
I'm sorry, less real. It certainly can be used for all the things that wealth can be used for in a capitalist economy. It can be used for the thing that is most important in a capitalist economy, that even defines it, to turn it into more money. In the sense that the money these banks make and the debts that they deal in function as capital, turning wealth into more wealth, and wealth in the sense that you can use it to really command the sources of wealth and make more. What the banks do is just as real as what the employers, as the wealth that the employers accumulate by exploiting labor, and it's just as much deserving of condemnation.
I agree, but they are exploiting labor indirectly because the capitalists and other investors fork over to them a certain share because they need to buy new equipment and they need capital advances from the banks.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, it has to be re-tied to the base. Otherwise, there is enormous dislocation and crisis in society. And it always happens. About every 11 years, or they get carried away, and they get disengaged, and they have a crisis, and enormous amounts of capital are destroyed, which paves the way for a new recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So what I don't see is they make money for themselves, but are they creating new value in society? That's what I don't understand. Maybe someone else can make it more simple.
Anyone else want to try and make it more simple?
Well, you want to go ahead?
Oh, I might.
Might to have disposal over things in a world of profit, of private property. And in this sense, this might of access, this might of two advancements of money, this might really is created by credit. We nowadays live in a world where the expansion of capital is not limited to the accumulation of yesterday's exploitation of labor, but it is actually limited by the chances of profits that are projected into the future.
Expectations,
yeah. They can, and this is something which nations, in which nations differ terribly. There are nations, and the United States is over the last half century the most important one of them. But now the European Union, with its money, with its currency, gets a similar ability. Nations differ not in the question of have they people who can work, not even in the question have they natural resources and all that stuff. They differ in the question can they advance capital, and can they in fact advance capital that has been earned, or capital that has been accumulated yesterday, but can they actually create out of nothing the advances with which capital business can be done, and with which everything a nation needs, including weapons, can be financed. And this, in this way, banks actually create additional power of access by creating credit. And this is really a creation process. This has to be taken seriously. This is really a creation out of nothing. One bank gives loans to another one. In the balance sheet of the one bank, the given money, the money that it has not anymore in its pocket, is considered for itself as its asset. Money the bank does not have anymore is an asset. The other bank now has this money. What does it do with it? It lends it to a third bank or to somebody else. And again, the money exists in the hand of the lender, of the borrower, and the asset exists in the hand of the lender. And by this, they multiply, actually. The money with which they can make investments and advances of any kind. And certainly your point is perfectly right, and I back it all the way. Crisis proves that credit is not money, but only an anticipation of future income. But this is not to be understood in the sense of, well, it is just a bit of an illusion. As long as it works, credit is capital. Credit is the might of advancing, of doing any advancements of money that are necessary for, well, all kinds of business in a nation.
Lehman Brothers was, the day before they crashed, as rich as they were. They owned the building, they invested in the businesses.
Yeah.
This is the might they had and the wealth they owned.
Imagine you look at the wealth of this nation and the wealthy of this nation, and what is existing? What does their wealth exist? In stocks and bonds. And what is this? Credit. Anticipation of future income, dealt with as present fortune.
Actually, to add something to it, if the credit would not be this power to purchase everything, no one would ask for a credit. And this is actually the basis why the companies and everyone needs the credit because of its power.
One point about that. In one sense, one could say credit is capitalistic wealth in its most perfect form. If it's not generating growth, it's worth nothing at all. If it's not used to make more money out of money, then it's worthless. That's something that the crisis teaches us. As soon as the debts upon which banks like Lehman Brothers and other investment banks were getting very, very rich, as soon as those debts no longer function as capital, as soon as they no longer find purchasers for the debts that they're issuing, the securities, then that money that wealth disappears. In that sense, true capitalistic wealth, it's either growing or it's dying, to use that phrase. And in that sense, it's also equivalent to money that's earned from hard-earned exploitation. If the money of a company producing toothbrushes is not used to accumulate capital, it's worth nothing at all. Also something that is proved by the crisis. As soon as firms no longer have the money to access credit, the money they might have is worthless. In that sense, the crisis demonstrates the identity in this economy of money and credit, namely as capital. If it's not growing, it's worthless. And that's why I guard against saying credit is merely a fantasy. I would say that's where you really see what capitalism is all about. There's got to be more questions. Yeah.
That's not a new idea there, you know. That's one of the big bones of contention with the Muslim fundamentalists. Usury is considered a great evil. Mm-hmm. They don't loan money to the interest. That's been on a long time. Mm-hmm. Even seems to me reading the Bible, Christ in the temple, the money lenders, you know, this goes on and on. It's been around a long time. It snowballs, gets way out of hand, is what happens. Everybody can get a little bit and they can leverage it. Nobody has any what you call Ponzi scheme. As it gets further and further afield, that's what you run into. All of a sudden, you end up like Bernie Madoff.
Well, in a certain sense, you know, saying a Ponzi scheme or a pyramid scheme, in a certain sense, the business, let's take these so-called special purpose vehicles, the origin of the current crisis. A pyramid scheme in what sense? If the business isn't growing, then what is revealed is the whole business is debts. As soon as there's no longer growth, no one can get paid off. Everyone is ruined. But I would warn against using terms like that, saying it's a Ponzi scheme, a pyramid scheme, that everybody knows is a crime. Yeah, an exaggerated, irresponsible kind of business. Instead, I would turn the issue around and say that is really the principle of the wealth in this capitalist society. Even if you're not committing a crime with your lending practices, the same principle holds true. If you're not drawing in more money and using it to accumulate more money, then the money is worthless.
That's a Ponzi scheme. Perfect definition of it. As long as they keep growing, everybody's happy.
But it's not a particularity of the banks, as well as General Motors. If you made a distinction, which what you're saying is not possible. General Motors is buying labor and whatever, only to do the same thing, to end up with more money in their hands than they had before, just like the banks. Whatever people do, which is pointed out, whatever they do with the lending itself, but he's lending actually looking at capitalistic money, himself money,
as an entity saying, I want to make more. And he could end up very well just as speculative. He does, he doesn't ask, are you buying my stuff? He's putting it on the market, like everyone else. So I don't see really the difference, first of all, from the nature of it, and second, what is the difference between the interest or the surplus you made? You know, because you had, I heard, it might be a false accusation, but it was kind of a moral standing and saying the interest, lending someone is taking interest, on, which by the way, the Islam do the same, they just don't call it interest, they call it a lending, you know what it
is. Lending wage, maybe?
Yeah. Pretty much the same thing. They say, I can't take interest, but you have to give me $5 for lending you $100. Whatever it is. So, I wasn't clear on how you do the differentiation between those who just basically give themselves credit and say, but their aim is make an extra profit, or just do this through another person who has some money in his hands left over and say, oh, take mine, but please, surplus, I need more than I have given you before. This is what this economy does. And it's different roles, one of the finance capital, the other go to the burden of buying people, it's just a joke. But I heard, it may, it's just a question to you.
I don't understand your question.
Does anyone else? Because I don't want to repeat it really. It's just because you said it goes back to Christ, and it sounded like lending is the crime. And I want to say making more money is not a crime, but it's just what this economy does in different ways. Sometimes it's called interest or surplus value.
Yeah, and lending for to get interest. That was the idea. That's usury. That's what it's called. Seems to me that's what we're talking about, the problem here. This whole thing of leverage is way out of control. When it goes out of control, it's...
I actually wanted to say something a little differently.
Okay.
You know, terms like usury or a Ponzi scheme, they make a distinction that I don't think is tenable. And what that is the distinction between, let's say, a responsible use of credit and an irresponsible use of credit.
Yeah, Sigma is necessary for certain larger projects.
Okay, seed money is necessary for certain projects, yeah? And what you mean by that is in order to be able to construct anything, let's say a bigger project in the society, you need money. In the same, you need credit, you need borrowed money. Okay. That's often taken as a reason to say banks, let's say at a certain modest level, are very important, are crucial to any production, process of production. And I would say banks are certainly useful for production in this economy. But that's not a reason to praise banks or to call for modesty on the banks. That's actually an indictment of this economy. That's what I was talking about in the beginning. Actually, what do you need credit for? Not at all for the physical process of production. It doesn't make labor any easier. People still have to work just as hard. It doesn't make machines run better. They still have to be designed, implemented, etc. Credit is useful for getting hold of all these goods.
That's right.
Yeah? But it's interesting. First of all, you have to get access to them. What does that teach us? That teaches us that the sources of material wealth in this society are not simply there for the purpose of producing it when there's a need to create certain, Marx called them use values, useful goods. Rather, they're all subject to the exclusive ownership of their owner. They're all subject to the rule of private property. That's why, because of that case, let's say, because that's the case, credit is useful in a society of private property. But because it's a society of private property, you can have the absurd situation that we call an economic crisis, which is not a lack of any material goods or sources of wealth. There's actually too much of it. For what purpose? Not for actually building things that people need, but for the purpose of turning money into more money. Because that's the purpose, and because material production is subordinated to that fact, credit is both useful and a credit crunch is fatal. And where I'd like to get you is not to say some banks are modest and helpful, and other banks are criminals, Ponzi's, Madoffs, I'm sure it's going to be a Madoff. I'm sure the word will become Madoff scheme now. But I'd like to get you to learn what the crisis actually teaches us. There was a Madoff, that's certain. But you had a whole banking system that in principle is doing the same thing. Instead of calling that criminal and actually saving the reputation of certain banks and capitalist companies, I would make my objection a little more principled, to put it another way. I would say that's an indictment of the purpose of production in this economy and not a reason to separate the Ponzi's from, let's say, the responsible bankers of old.
Projects are necessary regardless of the magnitude of these projects. If money enables them to be built, then there's a question to arise because it wasn't a lack of concrete, steel, or anything over labor. It was just a lack of money. Money, again, does not build these bridges. So the dependency on these fundings shows the well-being, let's say, communal well-being, well-being of society depends on this, is a critique of the very wealth money, the wealth we are looking for. It's a critique of it. If everything depends on the money to be made, then really, like in this society, like in the state right now, people are put out of work, business as well. Everything, nothing materially has stopped to exist. They just are not worth being produced. It's not for the use value, it's just for the exchange value. If it can be obtained, they don't produce it, regardless of the needs. And this is not new in the crisis. It's just more obvious because now everyone is out of work. And obviously, businesses are being hurt. But this depends on them. It would be redundant, so I hope that was clear.
But money is just that facilitates the distribution of goods and services. So you've got to have something like that, or how you keep your ledger straight. You can't get rid of that. You know, it's a big try the barter system or something, that might work on a small level.
Yeah, and you gave us three good points, three lessons that give us some understanding of the crisis.
I agree.
From let's say the capitalist point of view, I mean, what would they say Bernanke be telling the bankers right now that in terms of you screwed up or you need to change, or is there any maybe they're telling them nothing because they just sort of go on and they're not going to change. In some ways the credit crunch you said could kill a capitalist economy, how are the banks addressing that right now? Other than, they're getting $700 billion from the country.
Well, apart from what they say and think, one could say, how are they addressing the issue? What are they doing with the money?
Yeah.
They're doing their business.
What are they doing with the money? Or, are they... saying, hey, you got to reform the industry somehow, or?
No, and I would ask, why should they?
Because they ran into a credit crunch.
Right. Well, I pointed out before, whether Bernanke or Howie's outraged at them, I'm not exactly sure. But there has been a lot of outrage, obviously, at the whole financial industry. And the outrage is to say, you guys screwed it up for us all. You guys are so important for us. If you don't provide loans, we're all screwed. And instead of providing the useful loans that we need, you went off in your own casino, made speculative creations you didn't even understand yourself, and now we have an economic crisis. What underlies that outrage, that attitude? What underlies it is the idea that banks have a very important responsibility, that they're crucial for us, that they're actually a means for my livelihood. If we don't have banks, then obviously we can't produce useful goods, I can't have a job, my family starves, I starve. And that's why they at the same time say, that's why the banks need to get back to business. Their outrage at the banks is based on the fact that they accord the banks a very good role, actually. They have a very high opinion of what banks do, provide loans. What I want to say is, instead of being outraged at bankers, it's important to understand what banks do. Banks provide loans for the purpose of enrichment. The fact that the economy can use those loans is a reason to criticize the economy. It proves that the purpose of the economy is not to produce useful goods, not to create livelihoods for people, but to turn money into more money. So instead of outrage at the banks, and while hoping that they get back to business, actually, I would abandon my hopes for recovery and start to criticize both the banks and the economy that they serve. Do you see what I'm yeah, good.
So I'm wondering, once we start doing that, we stop distinguishing between good things and bad things, I mean, what are we looking towards? It's mm-hmm. socialism, right? I mean, so how do we get there? The educational places, staff administration, and what is this group ruthless criticism, how do they speak to?
Well, may I let ruthless criticism talk for themselves, but I mean, you're asking me what, you know, where does it go from here? What do we do from here? I like to take small steps. And the most important step, regardless of what comes afterward, is, well, not to be immodest, but to do what we're doing here tonight. The attitude of most people towards the crisis, it could have taught them something. The crisis could have really taught them how much the capitalist economy deserves to be overthrown, to be replaced with a means of production or a mode of production that produces for people's needs. Obviously, they didn't learn that lesson. The mood of the public, the stance of the public, I've said a few times tonight, they recognize in the crisis that they're very dependent upon the health of the banks, that they're very dependent upon profit making. And for that very reason, they hope that the same business gets going again. It would be a huge step, and that's not something I would underestimate, to get the people to change that attitude and say, if it's the case that the entire material, to say it with a bit of pathos, the entire material life process of society comes to a halt as soon as that purpose is no longer achieved, turning money into more money, then that's a reason to criticize that system and not hope for its recovery. As far as that goes, then I would say, spread that word. If you understood the message, spread the word. And then we'll see what comes then. I really wouldn't, yeah, like I said, wouldn't underestimate that attitude change. How much would be won with that? How much would be gained from that? And that's all we really have the capacity to do at the moment. Well, first of all, it would kind of depend on what the unions want. If I look at the unions right now, they're certainly not doing anything that I could support in any way. In fact, the opposite. Certainly. And, you know, even where they say, I would believe them, they regard themselves as representatives of the workers and to do something for the workers. What they say is we really need to create jobs and to do everything so that people get jobs. That's the recipe for the crisis. And quite logically, what that consists in is making compromises across the board.
Right. What's the difference between the workers?
Right. Well, that's definitely a difference, and the way the unions are acting sounds a lot like the management.
Right.
And what I would say is, as far as material interests of workers go, they're surely not representing them. What they are representing are the material interests of the workers in this economy, and that's exactly the problem with unions. They say, your interest in this economy is to have a job. That's the precondition for everything. Therefore, everything needs to be done to create jobs. And again, quite logically, that means improving conditions for employers to make money. And that's a, I would say that's a reason not to support, well, a movement that seeks to create jobs like that.
Maybe it helps. It's one thing that you have to live selling your body to a capitalist working for a year later, being paid wage labor. It's another thing taking this as an opportunity and not as a threat. See, I would say, well, you have to work, and as long as you can't pass this economy right now, let's negotiate for the highest possible salary and so on and so on. Because competition hurts the single worker, it would all go cheaper because the negotiation skills they have are non-existent. They do not have money to begin with. They have to survive in a system where the access to goods is only through money, provided only for labor. Okay, this is it. This is the scenery, the situation. It's a total different attitude and agitation of the union towards their members if you say, let's fight for jobs. And what I meant with that's a threat, because jobs are the jobs of the capitalist. You know, you don't own a job, you have to work, and it's the job the capitalists offer and create for one purpose only, and this is the only way it exists, to enable him again to make a profit. The profit itself is always his foundation to even increase the burden of the work itself, buying new machinery, making them work longer, and so on, and even increasing the parts of competition among labor. So jobs is nothing promising. Unfortunately, you have to do it right now. And it's a prerequisite right now to survive, but that's it. That's another, that would be an interesting agitation. The union would turn around and say, okay, right now we do this, but as soon as possible, if we're not, let's get rid of wage labor. And I don't think maybe I missed something. I haven't heard it in the United States. Actually, I haven't heard it.
No, it's definitely not been said.
Okay.
For sure.
And it wouldn't hurt to say this because
right. My friend Elise of Labor Union says, okay, at least in the States, management's terrible, but organizing among rank and file workers is a really big deal, because what better way to they're not the union, they get it, but I just think there's something to that, even though obviously management's selling short, and the so-called union leaders don't actually represent the interests of workers, they represent the interests of the bosses of these workers. I'm just saying it's an interesting concept to organize within labor unions, and also to prevent, as you are organizing, what obviously can't be gained under a capitalist structure, right? We can't all get health care. We can't all have houses that we own, or whatever, if that's really what we want. I don't know. But it's sort of transitional in a way. You know, like you said, baby stuff. Yeah. That's my thought.
Maybe it's worthwhile that I say a few sentences or a few sentences to the union, because you say it's a transition, it's a middle thing, yeah, if I understand it right. Unions are a double thing, that there are unions at all, that unions are founded, is a recognition of the fact that people who work in this society cannot live on the outcome of what they of their work. If they would let it to the capitalists to decide how much they pay them, they would starve. This is the one thing. And the other thing is that this insight that is really part of the foundation of labor union.
side is at the same time rejected by creating unions, let's say, what that follow the purpose, or that pursue the purpose of finding a way to live by wages, finding a way of compromise with the capitalists. If you take the first sentence serious, they are enemies. The second sentence is, it is only that they take too much of our product and we get too little. If we could get a little bit more and they would be content with a little bit less, it would do. If you realize you have to fight for your life, or you have to fight for your livelihood, you realize you are in hostile circumstances, then you should not look for compromise. So this one thing, yeah. And I would like to add something to the former debate about Ponzi scheme and real value and mere finance. It may be an interesting thing to see that the accumulation of financial assets apart from production is not just something that is illusionary and with no relation to the real economy. It is, on the one hand, with no relation to the real economy, in the sense of these trillions and trillions they have accumulated in these credit default swaps and all that stuff. They really haven't been produced anyplace. But on the other hand, this expansion of credit is at the same time the big driver of the real economy. Credit is easy to acquire. Credit is easily to have, and everything can be financed, and so growth is underway. The real growth is also the product of the credit expansion, and not the other way around. And only in the situation when the credit expansion crashes, only in this exceptional moment of the capital of the business cycle, only in this moment, this world knows or thinks to know about a difference of real economy and mere finance. In normal times, Wall Street is the economy, and the stock market level is the wealth of the nation. This is important. And even then, when there's a crash of credit, there is no redimensioning of the illusionary form of wealth to the real wealth. But it is, they detect or they experience that the permanent anticipation of future growth, which they deal with as present assets, this permanent anticipation is not, they can't uphold anymore. But this, not with the end, or this doesn't lead to the point that finance is redimensioned to the real value. This would be the absolute catastrophe. The state has salvage the banks in order to prevent this catastrophe. And now again, stock markets are already rising. Yeah, they have already recovered one third of the losses, or half of the losses, I don't even know. Why at the same time the real economy shrinks? Shrink a word?
Well, at least you said
that. Yeah, it is a word.
It is a word.
So, one has to see this subordination of the material world under this value thing, under the access to it, under the might of disposal over all forms of wealth. This subordination includes that credit is the final form of capital, is the real might in society, and the use value is only the means for it. This is never shown so clearly as in phases of crisis, where the real value is sacrificed, thrown away, in order to rescue the might of this disposal over all forms of wealth, all forms of real wealth. Supporting this society, it is not about the useful things. All of this is just a means for making money, and money is this might of disposal. Therefore, it is something that has to be contested. What this man over there, he's gone now, said that, well, money is just something to facilitate
distribution. Yeah.
No, in this society, money is the purpose, not the means, not a means. And if it was not about the might of disposal over all forms of wealth, you wouldn't need money in order to transport goods to the places where they are needed.
It would be about distribution. The easiest would have been giving these people who had all the mortgages the money instead of rather saving Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. It would have been, or you would notice Africa has a lack of money. Send it over, so they wouldn't get
the
distribution going.
Yeah, facilitate the trade there.
Apparently, a lot of money, a lot of people have been missed out by this distribution means that money has. So, open the central banks, open the doors, but most of the time they keep them closed. If you ask them, could I have some? If it's not with a gun, they won't. At least in my account, they won't. But that's another story. But so it's obvious it's not a distribution, a means of distribution. It excludes people from wealth.
Anything else? Eyes are drooping.
Well, what is the plan? What is Ruthless Christian next month plan on maybe discuss the healthcare debate, which is on, you know, still on its way.
Next month or next weekend?
No, I would say next month. You would post it probably and find a little spot.
We check our website, ruthlesscriticism.com. We update it all the time. We're always looking to have events like this, or just an informal discussion over coffee. Any subject, there's always constant disasters and things that are in the news that we can analyze and try and figure out the real reasons for them are.
We could, you know, I'm saying next month because we surely could do it next weekend, but, you know, there's not a million of people out here. We're here for another week, so we could do it, but I don't know how urgent you are up to discuss what, for instance, should be learned out of the healthcare debate on the sides of those who oppose general healthcare and also those who are the advocates of the coffee man. It would be interesting, but I think it's rather.
And not only that, but while you guys are here, if anyone is interested in talking about anything they might have questions on, we might schedule some time to talk.
For instance, over a beer and a burrito in a few minutes. If anyone's interested.
Yeah.
Okay. think most of it is free, but some of them are $5 just because arguments against money cost money.
Yeah. Books are, the books cost money, everything else, please, thank you.